Now for another subject that has to do with healthy living, but that I haven't talked about much. It's what you have in your house that's really not necessarily good for you. You might say to yourself, why would I even get involved in this? But the real reason is I have a very compromised health-wise grandson, 8 years old, 8 or 9. Coming 9. And he's very, very limited in some of his health. His lungs aren't quite right. And he gets around 5. But we were having a lot of trouble with him. Started looking for allergies and things. Boy, some of the stuff we came up with that were really affecting him and may affect other kids, but you don't even know how to check for it because he's not as healthy. He seems to show it worse. But one of the things we discovered that was a real problem, believe it or not, were the carpets in my daughter's home that, of course, the boy lives in. So anyway, here's some food for thought. Don't use wall-to-wall carpets if you can help it. The fibers and backing are all chemically treated. Padding and glues all come with their own chemical consequences. Some types of carpeting use chemicals that have been associated with, directly with, respiratory symptoms, which is what he had, eye irritations and rashes, as well as chemicals that can react with each other to produce formaldehyde, a known, incidentally, human carcinogen. Instead, where possible, use wood or tile flooring. We know this is a high bar to meet, especially because synthetic carpet is one of the most inexpensive floor coverings around. But carpet's negative impact on indoor air quality makes it hard to recommend. Solid wood flooring has a very low VOC finish. Tile with a little VOC sealant or cork or natural linoleum are good options to consider and come at a variety of price points. If you do choose or decide to use carpet, consider wool. Wool carpet is a healthier alternative. You'll be more likely to avoid the VOCs. That's called volatile organic compounds that aren't good for you. Okay, associated with synthetic fibers. Also look for wool or felt carpet padding. Wool carpet may be more expensive than synthetic, but it's a natural, renewable fiber, biodegradable, and is long-lasting, especially if well-maintained. For some reason, you have to choose synthetic carpet. Look for what's called Green Label Plus or Green Guard Certified Carpet and Padding. These carpets are and paddings are very low in VOCs and will limit the area covered with carpet. And really important, especially if you have a compromised child or someone you're worried about, avoid carpets that have stain or waterproofing treatments. They're almost always made out of chemistries that just really aren't good for your health in the long run. If you find you have to use adhesives, look for low VOC adhesive. Those adhesives do not contain harmful solvents or better, install carpet using hook fastener systems that require no adhesive at all. When you're selecting your area rugs, choose wool or natural plant materials every time you can. Look for materials such as jute, seagrass, or sisal. And there are some natural rubber non-skid padding. And there's even some decent now carpet. I mean, it's good. It's not inexpensive. Made from nothing but pure bamboo. And the one thing they taught us with our child is, regardless of flooring, use doormats, and when you get a chance, don't wear shoes indoors. That's a big practice over other parts of the world that we don't seem to practice very much. Taking off your shoes prevents tracking in a number of pollutants you might have got walking on lawns or anywhere. So either alter a pair of shoes or just barefoot in the house is probably the best idea. If you'd like more information than just what I gave you, I just want to kind of touch it, let you know what you're to be looking for, go to EWG, that's the Environmental Working Group's Healthy Living Home Carpet Guide. Let's take just a few minutes here and talk about beavers and what's going on with climate change and beavers. Beavers have a remarkable ability to transform landscapes. Using their sharp teeth, they fell trees and shrubs and they build dams, which cause small valleys to fill with water and form new lakes. Some of these lakes measure 5 or 10 acres in size, a few even more. And beavers are very efficient builders. They often build their dams at precisely those points where they can have the greatest effect with the least effort. Scientists studying beaver activity in the Arctic regions of Alaska have found that the changing climate is leading to a substantial increase in the beaver populations and their effect on the landscape. In 2018, researchers found that the beavers living in a 7,000 square mile area northwest Alaska had created 56 new lakes in just 5 years. Thanks to rising temperatures, more and more habitats offered the shrubs that beavers need for food and their building material. In addition, the lakes, which used to freeze solid, now offer beaver-friendly conditions. Also, beavers are not hunted as intensely as they were in the past. The scientists were surprised that beavers had seized the opportunity so intensively. There is basically an exponential growth in beaver dams. This is actually a worrisome situation. Forming all those new lakes degrades the ice-rich permafrost in the area. In the Kotzebue region of Alaska, the overall water area has increased by more than 8% in just over 17 years, and roughly two-thirds of that is due to beaver dams. The degradation of the Arctic's permafrost is a dangerous situation, and it appears that anyone who wants to predict its future has to keep the activity of the beavers in mind. I just might add here, a few weeks ago, I actually did another, I call it, two-minute organic matters fact about beavers, but on the good side. So I want to give them both sides here again. In a situation like this where they're not controlled, we've wiped out a lot of the predators that used to keep them down. Now the weather's warmer, so they've got more water. They're just being more successful. In years past, beavers were literally almost hunted to extinction. And then the Forestry Service started working with them, and now they're actually, you'll love this, they're parachuting beavers back into parts of the Rocky Mountains and the other mountains in the West to reestablish those lakes that they used to build that everybody thought was so negative. We've wiped our populations of wild trout and other things down because there's not enough of that natural lake anymore. And even though, yes, they do cut down some trees, they are indeed a real positive part of an ecosystem that builds around everything the beavers do. Even the elk and a number of other animals depend on the trees that grow as fresh growth. When the beavers take down the older trees, it literally stimulates new growth in that area. So good side and the bad side of beavers. I happen to think they're pretty cool, but like everything, you know, an animal in the wrong place can be a problem. But I like that they're putting them back as much as they can in nature. And I have been to a couple of places where they've been in a decade or so now, and the befores and afters of that country was amazing how much they had, I want to use the word corrected, but certainly got nature back the direction it was, yeah, maybe even 50 or 100 years ago. With so much going on in the world these days, sometimes we overlook things that still need to be considered. Each week now, I try to do at least a couple of minutes on what we've learned in the latest studies on what we'd call climate change scientific facts. In this new study just also released this June, climate change models have underestimated the amount of carbon dioxide that will be emitted from thawing permafrost by as much as 14%, according to a new study just published in the journal Geophysical Research Letters. But do let me throw this in just so that you'll understand where I get my info from. A lot of people in the radio and TV business don't bother telling you that some of the research they quote just comes out of a newspaper or somewhere. The things that I use each week are what we call peer-reviewed. In other words, they've been looked at by several scientists in agreement, and if they don't agree, they go back and figure it out. But that's the only science papers that we should believe in are those that have actually been at least studied by a few people in the field. When are we going to learn? The scientists do know what they're talking about, not the politicians. The research incorporates a key pathway for CO2 to enter the atmosphere that is missing from other models. When carbon from thawing permafrost is flushed into waterways and converted to CO2 by sunlight. Scientists estimate that big number, folks, try to get a grip on this, I can't, 1,500 billion metric tons. I can't do that. It's too many zeros. A lot of carbon locked away in the Arctic permafrost, and that 5 to 15% of that carbon could be emitted as carbon dioxide in the next 50 or 60 years. enough to increase global temperatures by at least a half of a degree Celsius. But these estimates do not include the CO2 that forms when permafrost carbon escapes into Arctic lakes and rivers and is oxidized by ultraviolet invisible light, a process known as photomineralization. Researchers from the University of Michigan studied organic carbon from six different Arctic locations and found that substantial carbon dioxide emissions could be released through photomineralization enough to raise permafrost-related CO2 emissions by a little over 14%. Only recently have global climate models included greenhouse gases from thawing permafrost soils, but none of them contain this feedback pathway. Rose Corey, an environmental scientist at the University of Michigan, who helped to lead the research, said this is just new information that we're learning more about every day. Scientists have previously been cautious about including photomineralization in their models because it can be difficult to measure exactly how sunlight interacts with soil carbon. But Corey and her colleagues developed a new tool that uses LED lights to measure the impacts of different wavelengths of light on organic carbon. They were then able to determine how light exposure affects the amount of soil carbon converted to CO2 emissions, as well as other factors that might accelerate the reaction. For example, the research team also found that the amount of iron in the soil plays an important role in the photomineralization process. What we have long suspected is that iron catalyzes this sunlight-driven process, and that's exactly what our results show, Corey said in a statement. As the total amount of iron increases, the amount of carbon dioxide increases right along with it. This finding is just one of the reasons that our earlier predictions of climate change, we used to call it climate warming, were underestimated. We are still just learning all the little nuances that take place and affect the overall changing of our climate.